Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Irina Zhorov.
And I'm Rebecca Martinez. Warm weather tourist traffic is winding down in Yellowstone National Park, and they're getting ready for winter tourists. The National Park Service bans over-snow vehicles in all national parks unless individual parks pass rules permitting and regulating them. Yellowstone has been refining its rules regulating snowmobile and snow coach traffic for about 15 years and released the final rule this week, which will kick in next winter. Yellowstone Superintendent Dan Wank says many parks see the winter as a time to rest after busy summer visitation.
It's an incredibly great time of the year to visit the park. It's a beauty that really is unlike anything most people have ever seen. And a lot of people want to make sure that two things happen. Number one, people have the opportunity to see the incredible beauty of Yellowstone in the winter. But if they do, they want to make sure that it is done in a very thoughtful way that respects the air quality, the sound, doesn't harass wildlife, and provides a high quality of visitor experience.
Is the park any more delicate during the winter?
I think there's a lot of concern about pushing wildlife around the park using over-snow vehicles. Their wildlife is in a greater period of stress. They have less nutritional opportunity for food. So I think it is more delicate in terms of the stresses that it places on wildlife, yes.
Now, getting a long-term winter use plan established has been a complicated process. Can you tell me how this final document came together?
Well, I think after 15 years, the last 2 years, we decided that we needed to really take a more science-based approach to how we looked at winter use. And so we looked at a method by which we would evaluate how animals responded to over-snow access and how we can make sure that we kept the park cleaner and quieter. And so we actually changed from absolute numbers of vehicles. Currently, it's based on 318 snowmobiles and 78 snow coaches, and changed it, seeing if we can actually allow for more visitation, which we found a way to do by requiring new standards for snowmobiles and snow coaches, and also by changing from absolute numbers of vehicles to transportation events. By managing it by transportation events, it has less impact on wildlife.
Can you tell me who can go where and how under the new plan?
The new rule will allow 110 transportation events a day. That will be broken down between no more than 50 snowmobile events, and a minimum number allowed will be 60 snow coach events. We require best available technology snowmobiles. For example, we're requiring about a 25% reduction in the carbon emissions from snowmobiles. And we're also requiring about a 75% reduction in the sound that's emitted from snowmobiles. Of those 50 snowmobile events, four, one per entrance, will be allowed to be non-commercially guided. So if you have your own snowmobile and it meets the new best available technology standards, you will be allowed to come into the park without having a commercial guide. You will be required, however, to take a certification online to make sure that you understand how to deal with wildlife, for example, when you come into the park. So the 110 transportation events per day will be divided among the entrances, and so that if you want to visit, you can make a reservation through one of the operators at one of the entrances. You can come into the park by your choice of transportation, either snowmobile or snow coach, and you can have a unique, perhaps once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to visit Yellowstone in the winter.
A few months ago, I spoke with Wyoming author Marjane Ambler, who spent 9 winters in Yellowstone in the 80s and 90s when her husband was a snowplow driver there. She says she thinks it's a shame that access to Yellowstone is so limited in the winter, just allowing people with the money for guided tours or time for certification and money for these expensive snowmobiles to see how amazing the place is in the snow. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think that there are many ways to visit Yellowstone National Park. Not just snowmobiles, and, you know, she's right, snowmobiles are expensive. If you don't have a new best available technology, however, you can rent a new best available technology machine. But the other way, which is far more affordable, is to get on snow coaches. And snow coaches enter the park from all of the entrances into Yellowstone, and that's a much more affordable way to visit the park. There really are no other options other than over-snow vehicles to visit the park in the winter unless you want to cross-country ski into some of the features, and that is allowed as well. But to plow the roads, for example, was something that we considered early on in the process, and it was dismissed because it would create new wildlife corridors and change the habitat for animals. This rule, first and foremost, protects Yellowstone National Park. It does make the park quieter, cleaner for winter use, and it does allow for an increase in visitation, and that I'm very pleased that it has received initial support from both the environmental community, the access community, and local communities that surround the park.
Thank you so much for talking with me.
No problem. Have a good day.
Dan Wink is the superintendent of Yellowstone National Park. The National Park Service released its winter use rule for Yellowstone this week.
In such an arid state as Wyoming, water is precious. Last year, the University of Wyoming created the Wyoming Center for Hydrology and Geophysics, combining field experts and state-of-the-art technology to better understand where water goes after it falls from the sky, since much of it ends up in snowpack or underground. There isn't too much information available about that, but it's important to state and local water managers who need to know just how much water they have to work with. Rebecca Martinez reports.
UW hydrogeophysicist Steve Holbrook is hunched over his GPS, marking the coordinates over points along long ground cables in a field near Vitavu in the Laramie Range. The wind whips around him as his team stands by, waiting for him to finish so they can begin seismic testing of the ground below. They know there's got to be water under there because someone dug a working well nearby.
They know about where they hit the water. We'd like to see if we can spot that aquifer with our geophysical data and track it laterally.
Holbrook co-directs the Wyoming Center for Hydrology and Geophysics, or YKEG. The program combines known water table data with their measurements about the subsurface. Porous layers of rock underground could contain water, and YKEG is trying to figure out where they are, how the water gets there, and how much there is. One of the grad students on Holbrook's team generates seismic waves by slamming a mallet onto a steel plate on the grass. And Holbrook checks out the results on his laptop.
Scientifically, what we're hoping to do is understand better where the water's going. How much of it is staying in soil moisture? How much of it is getting stolen down into these deeper groundwater aquifers? How much of it turns into runoff? How much of it evaporates off from the snow and so forth?
Previously, the best information about groundwater aquifers has come from drillers' logs compiled when digging private and municipal wells.
That tends to be kind of a hit or miss, scattershot. There's a well here, but not over there, and there's not really a lot of information about what's in between the wells or what's beyond the wells. And that's part of what we're after, is producing techniques and making available technologies to stakeholders in Wyoming that enable us to look beyond the few wells that exist.
Hydrologist Scott Miller, Holbrook's colleague and co-directing YKEG, says the program can take a more holistic approach to mapping and measuring aquifers, including taking helicopter surveys of geological changes in a landscape, seismically measuring snowpack and the ground's subsurface, and creating models on the NCAR supercomputer near Cheyenne. Miller says combining this data with existing knowledge about state aquifers can be extremely useful to water managers.
And so if you can map the amount of water in the aquifer, the depth of the aquifer, and then the pressure, then you know how much water is available and in what direction it's flowing, which allows you to put wells to acquire that water resources more effectively.
But gathering all this information is incredibly expensive. Luckily, the National Science Foundation awarded the program a $20 million grant, the largest in UW's history. The university offered a $4 million matching grant. After 4 years, YKEG will need to find its own support, but UW has also agreed to hire 8 new faculty and staff positions permanently. Equipment and data will be available to outside companies and agencies for their own use as well. Miller says that's important since changes in water availability can impact users downstream.
So we have two areas that we really care about. One is how much water is going to be available to the citizens and the ecology of the state of Wyoming, and then how we can deliver our water across state lines down to those millions of people who are in the downstream states.
For example, the state engineer's office is charged with supervising and protecting water flowing into and out of Wyoming. River Coordinator Matt Hubler ensures that the state complies with interstate water compacts and decrees for the North Platte River. Hubler says 26 municipalities depend on that river for water, and they have varying water rights. Hubler says having a more precise idea of how much water will be available in a given summer would be crucial in planning.
For the sake of examples, if we know that runoff is going to be extremely light this year, should that municipality water the cemetery, the town parks, the golf courses? Do they put every water user on a gallonage restriction?
Hubler says it can have a much bigger impact than household water use. If the cost of water rises, it could affect how much oil refineries choose to process or how much alfalfa a farmer decides to grow and where. Hubler says other federal snowpack and river flow monitoring programs are shrinking quickly, but as populations grow, so does the need for good data. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Martinez.
When we come back, we'll hear about two men's passionate quest for a new energy source and an interview about hiking the Continental Divide Trail. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Irina Zhorov.
And I'm Rebecca Martinez. Many retired people take up a hobby, knitting, birdwatching, bingo. But two Laramie retirees have decided to spend their days in pursuit of a decidedly less mainstream pastime, solving the energy challenges of our time. Wyoming Public Radio's Stephanie Joyce has the story.
It's a sunny fall day, and Dave Earnshaw is standing outside the Central Energy Plant at the University of Wyoming, staring out over the empty field that sits next to it.
200 megawatt nuclear reactor would fit right there. It wouldn't take up even as much room as the dirt pile down there.
Obviously, Earnshaw isn't talking about your average nuclear reactor. He's talking about what's called a liquid fluoride thorium reactor, or LFTR, and he says comparing the two is like comparing apples and oranges. He sat down recently to look at the licensing regulations for nuclear power plants.
And I looked him over and I said, well, not necessary. Not necessary. Not necessary. Multiple rules about what you have to do about cooling water. Don't need any cooling water.
You also don't need huge amounts of storage space for waste because LFTRs don't produce much. And because the reactors work at ambient pressure, there's little risk for a catastrophic blowout. The technology has been called revolutionary and game-changing, but it's been slow to catch on. That's hugely frustrating to Earnshaw.
It's just that there's so many advantages that's why I think it would really be world-changing. Just world-changing.
So Dave Earnshaw has taken it upon himself to become a LFTR evangelist, and he's enlisted his friend, Dave Copeland, in the effort. Both are retired scientists. Earnshaw is an environmental scientist, and Copeland is a geologist. For the last 3 years, Dave and Dave have been meeting every week at El Conquistador, a kitschy Mexican restaurant in downtown Laramie, to discuss LFTR. The goal of these meetings is to develop a packet of information that can be distributed to legislators, engineers, and yes, journalists. Dave Copeland explains how they got started.
We are folk dancers. For the last 30 years or so, we've been hard at it.
And so you met through folk dancing. How on earth did nuclear power come up?
Well, because we were friends and I knew he was doing a lot of editing work and so on, I just mentioned.
Copeland regularly does editing for geology publications. So Earnshaw asked him to help write up a slew of documents on LFTR, including a vision paper, several articles, and a case study that looks at how it could be used to produce synthetic fuels. Copeland says in the process, he got just as hooked as Earnshaw on the idea.
To me, it's the key element in a total energy regime and the opportunity that it offers to the state is just huge. It's huge.
The two think using a thorium reactor would be cheaper and cleaner than existing sources of energy and would provide a new use for Wyoming's largest traditional source of revenue, coal.
Just did some kind of scratching on the back of an envelope, so to speak. Said, well, what would happen if instead of gasifying coal, that we hydrogenate coal? And the benefit are multiple.
Hydrogenating coal produces synthetic fuel, which can be turned into a variety of liquids, including gasoline and jet fuel. But it requires a large supply of hydrogen, which is costly to produce because of the energy that's required to split it from natural gas or water. Enter the thorium reactor. If you're wondering what the drawback is, Well, there are potentially lots of them. LIFTR has never been used commercially. A test reactor ran at Oak Ridge for several years in the 1960s, but there are plenty of skeptics when it comes to whether it would work outside of a laboratory. Those naysayers haven't dampened the Dave's enthusiasm. Earnshaw says he's happy to respond to critics.
I'd have an open debate with him, as a matter of fact.
Whether he'll get that opportunity remains to be seen. Getting the public interested in LIFTR, let alone passionate about it, has proved challenging. Last year, the Daves helped bring an expert on the technology to present to the legislature, but the reception was lukewarm. And the constant talk about it can get tiresome.
My friends all run when they see me coming. And I said, I'd talk to anybody. And one of my friends says, yeah, you'd talk to a rock about LIFTR.
Despite the chilly reception, the Daves have no plans to stop talking. Out at the power plant, Earnshaw tells me the 20 years he spent researching oil shale were a waste.
And so I said, before I die, I'd like to really come up with, help the world with something that really will work and really will do some good.
And he's pinning that dream on LIFTR, even if for now, he's the only one who can envision a nuclear reactor in the empty space next to the university's energy plant. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
The Continental Divide Trail is a hiking path that runs from Canada to Mexico along the Great Divide. It's more than 3,000 miles long, and only a handful of people hike the whole thing in a single year. Mark Kuplin of Cheyenne is one of them. He and his hiking partner finished the trail a few weeks ago and joined Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden to talk about the trip. He says his first long-distance hike was the Appalachian Trail, which he did 12 years ago.
Most people who hike these trails will all tell you they're in a transitional state, and I was kind of in the same between jobs and a girlfriend left and that kind of thing. And what better thing to do than to go out in the woods and, you know, enjoy. So
that was your first
hike? So I hiked that. And then 2 years ago, I hiked the Pacific Crest Trail, and I just loved it. And I remember how hard it was to reintegrate after the AT. So now I'm kind of thinking, I'm just going to keep hiking.
Reintegrate, as in go back into the real world.
Yeah, into society and all that. It's not hiking is so much easier. So
much easier. I bet a lot of listeners are going to wonder about that. I mean, doing these trails where you're hiking for thousands of miles doesn't sound easy.
No, I guess, I don't know, it's a matter of perspective. Some might even think it's crazy, but I think crazy is working the same job for 30 years. And for me, that's, you know, it's never been my my thing. And the other thing is when you're in the woods, it's the only thing, it comes down to basic necessities. You know, you got your water, your food, and your clothing, and that's it. There's no stress, and like I get migraine aura attacks, and out in the woods, it never happens. As soon as I get back into society, I get all kinds of all my maladies and ailments back. So
you should keep hiking for health reasons.
Yeah, for health reasons.
Okay, so what was the scariest moment on the trail?
The scariest moment on the trail. The late snow in Colorado forced us to do a bunch of pole tolling and walking above tree line. And
post-holing is when you're walking through snow, but you don't have snowshoes, so you just sink in.
Right, and all suddenly, and the thing about it is, it's if you expect it, you can, you know, kind of deal with it. You fall to your, you know, like thigh or waist, and you can get out. But the problem with the snow in Colorado is one step will give way, and the next one's solid. So it's a constant guessing game. And after, you know, 8, 9, 10 hours of doing that, you're done with doing that. So we took an alternate to try to cut off, called the Creed Cutoff, through the San Juans. We basically were following this river, and we kept having to ford it because it was narrow on the sides, and we got to the point where the ford was becoming too much flow going, and so we were going to end up at the bottom of that, wherever that fed into. So we had to basically bushwhack up the mountains, and the problem is, in this section of the San Juans, is the pine beetle kill is so dense. There's so many blowdowns, and it was the only time I've actually been afraid in the woods, pretty much.
Afraid because you weren't sure you were going to get out of where you were?
Yeah, because it was just the water, the fording was too much, so that was no longer an option. And to go back, we could have gone back, but it would have been going back up over the San Juan and the icy passes and snow, and it was just, it was the first time I actually kind of felt a little, you know, not at ease in the woods. It was the only time, really. Maybe that and the first time I ever hiked, but the other problem with this trail, and I wanted to say a low light for this one would have been the 2 weeks of, you know, quote unquote biblical flooding in Colorado. It's one thing to, you know, be inside your house and yeah, it's a little rain outside, but you know, unless of course your house floats away, unfortunately for a lot of those good people. But in a tarp, you know, I was building levees and ditches and underneath my tarp to, you know, basically make the water go away and you know, divert it. So that was not fun, being wet every day.
So did everything you own get wet during that period of time?
Right. And you know, a lot of these gear people, they'll tell you about, you know, waterproof this and breathable. And after, you know, just 2 days in biblical rains, it doesn't matter what it is. Everything you own is getting wet.
How do you prepare for a hike like this? Or how do you train for it?
I tend to cut down my beer usage just a little bit. I bike everywhere. I've integrated. I'm a firm believer in integrating, you know, exercise into my daily routine. So I'm never going to work on my upper arm strength and go to the gym because I never need to go. You know, I don't need that. The only thing I really need is my legs and cardio. So I just kind of work. I don't really train that much, honestly. There's two school of thoughts on that. A lot of people don't think it matters what you do because after 2 weeks on the trail, you're going to already be trained to do it. Or there's those people who are out there every day at 5 a.m. running and getting ready for it. And so I'm part of the former school. I just kind of, whatever, I figure out.
Train as you go.
Yeah, train as I go. Yeah.
So now how do you make this work, this hiking habit of yours, how do you make this work with having a job?
I kind of look at it as retiring every year. Whatever I can do in the 6 months in between hiking season. Right now I'm working online. There's a website called Mechanical Turk. Just do little electronic hits for, you know, 2 cents each and a click worker. I do content writing and just regular writing and blogging. There's a lot of ways to make money without having to have a real job, I think.
So overall, what was your favorite part about the trail?
Overall, not working. No, that's not that simple. It's like crack cocaine to me or something. It's when you're out there, it's a euphoria that it's hard to explain until you're actually just out there. And there's a comfort zone. The first 2 weeks when you're still getting your trail legs and there's all these difficulties, you're still, you know, dialing in how many calories and food you're going to need and all that. And once you got all that logistics and all you're doing is just walking and your mind is completely unfettered, there's not a single boss or any obligation to think about. And just when you're in that moment, you're free.
All right. Well, Mark, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Willow. Thank you very much.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden talking with Mark Kuplin, who finished hiking the Continental Divide Trail a few weeks ago.
Coming up, a story about conservation on ranches and the search for the perfect grape in Wyoming. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Irina Zhorov.
And I'm Rebecca Martinez. Ranchers have always planned for the next season and the next generation, and as such have been natural conservationists. But new management tools in the conservation toolbox are making it easier for landowners to be successful stewards of their land. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhorov reports that ranchers are up for the challenge.
On the Snake River Ranch in Jackson, Barbara Hagee's looking at a map of the property. She's one of the original founder's grandchildren who manage the operation today. The map she's looking at, drawn in 1937, shows the fence lines of the ranch from back then.
See, they go by 40-acre pastures for the most part, and they're very geometric.
She then shifts to a modern map of the ranch. She traces one of the pasture fence lines with her finger.
One thing that might strike another person is how irregular some of the pastures are.
Today, they let stream banks and vegetation dictate fence locations. The decision was made when the family noticed that young trees weren't doing well on their property.
It was because the grazing animals made it very hard for the young trees to get a start and to survive. So the family decided that we valued those trees. And when we had to replace the fences, we wanted to replace the fences so that they would protect the woody vegetation that we had.
The family does it because they enjoy the trees and to provide habitat for wildlife like moose, elk, owls, deer.
Higgy drives out into a pasture shaped like a craggy claw. It's all neatly trimmed grass, but it's surrounded by overgrown woody stands, which she calls tree pastures. There's an enormous elk in the brush.
And that's what the bull elk needs, and that's why we're protecting that pasture. So you see the payoff right here as you're here on the ranch.
The fencing project is just one of several conservation-minded management practices the ranch has instituted over the years. And the Snake River Ranch isn't alone either.
It's nothing new, really.
That's Bob Budd, executive director of the Wyoming Wildlife and Natural Resource Trust, which helps people with conservation projects on their land. He says ranchers have always operated with an eye to sustainability.
What is new is the range of alternatives that are out there that people can look at.
It's not just fencing. There are improvements in irrigation methods and technology, grazing practices that are easier in the land, riverbank restoration projects, and things like conservation easements, which protect land in perpetuity. Timory Hellier ranches with her family east of Lander. Ranching is a traditional occupation, but she says ranchers evolve willingly.
As technology has advanced and people's information and realm of possibilities has advanced, then we have these different opportunities, and each one is a level that's more efficient and conserves more than the last level.
In her area, she's seen many people install center pivot irrigation, which is costly but conserves a lot of water. Bud says those advances in technology and ranchers' willingness to use them are a good thing for conservation on a landscape scale.
A lot of our best winter habitat is on those lands. A lot of our best nesting habitats, the stuff that's vast blocks of public land, tend to be a little more arid or a little higher elevation, and those all have their practical limitations.
There are difficulties with private land, too. Randy Williams is the executive director of the Teton Conservation District, which also helps ranchers. He says they need help navigating new challenges.
A lot of what they're facing is, at times, I think, surrounding development that in the old days simply wasn't present. And so learning to get along with neighbors and subdivisions and increased transportation routes and those types of things.
All of the conservation assistance programs are voluntary, in contrast to many industries today. Hellier, the Lander rancher, says it's nice help for things they do anyway.
I think that most ranchers that you would visit at any given time do practice what the rest of the world would call conservation practices. But I think that ranchers, for the most part, view it as taking care of their business properly.
Because ranching often spans generations, making sure that the resources are in good shape ensures continuing returns on the investment. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhurov.
Wyoming might not be the first choice for grape growers and aspiring vintners, but a group in Sheridan is working to change that. Professors, graduate and undergraduate students at UW and Sheridan College are using advanced techniques to identify traits in different grape varieties that make them well-suited to Wyoming. Wyoming Public Radio's Chelsea Biondolillo reports.
Sadhan Ondekni is a UW horticulture professor stationed at the Sheridan Research and Extension Center. On the far edge of the Sheridan campus near the other greenhouses, he and his research team tend a small plot surrounded by deer fencing and crisscrossed with black irrigation tubing.
This is a one-acre vineyard, so 17 rows are being used for a grape variety trial, and we have planted 35 different varieties in here with the goal to identify suitable varieties for Wyoming.
Deckney believes that Wyoming's dry weather is a major benefit to growers, as grapevines are susceptible to fungus in wet areas like the West Coast. Though he acknowledges that early frosts and late thaws are limiting factors here.
This age at which you can start commercial production varies from place to place. Under Wyoming conditions, it takes anywhere from 3 to 4 years, considering our short growing season. One of the objectives of this variety trial is to see varieties that can be established at a faster rate.
Deckney's research uses biotechnology to identify the best traits from a wide range of grape varieties. The ultimate goal is to create new Wyoming-tolerant grapes by combining those traits. About a half an hour away, on a windy and otherwise bare hilltop in Parkman, Stephanie Zier tends around 200 grapevines behind her house. For her, the vineyard is still a hobby, but she hopes to make it a business in the future. When asked why she chose grapes, which are an atypical Wyoming crop, she said that despite the short season, the Wyoming landscape seemed ideal for grapes.
you know, what you read about grapes is that the more you torture them, the better fruit you get. And I thought, well, I can certainly torture a plant.
An avid Telemark skier, Zier has named her operation Telly Peak Vineyard. She's also one of Deckney's statewide local grower partners.
The first thing I did after coming here is getting a lot of information from the growers. And so that helps me get a head start in giving the direction for our research.
And also when you evaluate different plants, you know that certain varieties, just when 10 people tell you that they planted them and they died in year two, that maybe there's not a whole lot of reason to look reevaluate them.
Deckney gathers information from Zier, and in turn, he can share plant material with her when it's ready to be tested in the field. In this way, the work at Sheridan College benefits the research project as well as Telly Peak Vineyards and other vineyards as far away as Basin and Huntley. Back at the research vineyard in Sheridan, Deckney and his students are joined by Dan Berge, the Sheridan College faculty advisor on the project. Berge teaches biology and biotech courses at Sheridan and sees this project as a way to jumpstart his students' academic careers.
Collaboration like this enables students at the community college level to funnel into the research system and advanced degrees with UW so they can get training here, get their feet wet in research, get hands-on practical application and training, and then go right into an advanced research program, an advanced PhD, a graduate program, or even medical dental PA school.
While students and vintners across the state get a majority of the benefits of the research, they aren't alone.
It's a win-win situation for everybody. For me, it's an opportunity to still do research as well as my teaching duties, but I can dabble in research, and it's very interesting. And I think we're the only institution in the state doing grape research, aren't we? I think this is it.
Deckney and Berge agree that Wyoming may never rival California's Napa Valley, but they both believe that grapes might someday be an important part of Wyoming's agriculture. Deckney's current project is scheduled to last for at least the next 10 years, with support from the Wyoming Department of Agriculture. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Chelsea Biondalillo.
Playwright William Missouri Downs says Ayn Rand's rational, objective philosophy helped him through college. But in Downs' newest play, certainty is lacking. Writer and philosopher Ayn Rand is put on trial, and the audience is the jury. Wyoming Public Media's Micah Schweitzer spoke with William Missouri Downs.
The play, An Evening with Ayn Rand, relies on improvisation and audience interaction, most importantly at the end, where three counts against Rand are considered. Did she fail to live up to her own standards? Did her principles of rational selfishness lead to social Darwinism? And did laissez-faire capitalism cause the recent economic crisis?
Those are the major questions, yes, of the play. And there is no definite answer. Every night it'll be different. You know, if we have more liberals in the audience one night, they might vote one way. More Tea Partiers in the audience the next, they might vote the other way. We have no idea how it's going to end.
And it's an interesting play because it's one of these opportunities for art to have a really concrete intersection with the real world and our economy and the society we live in.
Yeah, I think art always does. It's entertainment that doesn't have an intersection. Entertainment reaffirms your values and makes you feel good about who you are and what you believe. Art is there for the artist to state an opinion independent of the audience about how the world is and or should be. And that is what we don't have enough of in our society today. Plenty of entertainment. We're the entertainment capital of the world. We don't seem to have much art here in the United States. Not much left.
Is that an audience problem or is that an artist problem?
It's an audience problem. The problem is that the audience has become convinced of absolutes. And this is helped by the media, which gives you two different versions of the news. The idea of where we get our information, how do you know what you know, is a major problem in our society today because we only listen to what we want to hear, and thereby we reaffirm our values. Our news has become entertainment, and you don't have to think. You know, once a friend of mine came to me and said, I found a book I completely and totally agree with. And I looked at it, and they had read it three times. They'd highlighted it with three different color markers. And I said, throw this book away. And they said, why? And I said, because that's the book you can't learn anything from. And we have a society both on the right and on the left today that no longer read the opposite point of view.
Isn't that part of the appeal with Ayn Rand, is that she has a very absolute approach to life?
Absolutely. That's absolutely. Ayn Rand is absolute, absolutely. She presents you with one way of living that she seldom questioned and her followers never question. And having absolutes is great because you know what to do. Human beings thrive for absolutes in their lives so that they really don't have to have the existential angst or the Hamlet-like delays that are the reality of existence.
But Hamlet's indecision leads to inaction.
Oh, yeah. And I think that if you have too few absolutes in your life, well, then you lose the name of action, as Hamlet says. But too many, and you know exactly what to do before you get the facts. And that's the problem.
And so in some sense, by having a play that can end differently each night, you're fighting against that sense of absolute. Even the play itself is not absolute.
Even the actors. We're doing a great deal of work with improvisation. We're planning on the possibility even of people speaking up in the audience, perhaps disturbances in the audience, and how to handle it and how to have dialogue going on instead of a fixed play that has a beginning, middle, and end exactly the same every night. This one is more of a performance art piece. And Ayn is glorified. Ayn is attacked. And then you, the audience, make the decision.
So what do you bring as the playwright? Do you have an outcome that you're rooting for?
Well, it's interesting because we had a number of readings of the play. And I think I'm doing my job well, at least, because the way the audience has voted in the readings has been different every time. So
so you're not stacking the deck.
Playwrights stack the deck. All artists stack the deck. That's the definition of being an artist, because we select and arrange the reality into these neat little absolutes. Because we want to say something, I'm certainly not neutral, but I don't want to say which way I am, because I want everyone to come.
That's William Missouri Downs. His new play, An Evening with Ayn Rand, runs October 29th through November 2nd at the University of Wyoming. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Micah Schweitzer.
Coming up, an interview with Wyoming author Nina McConaughey. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Irina Zhurov.
And I'm Rebecca Martinez. Nina McConaughey is a lecturer in the University of Wyoming's English department. Her new book is a collection of short stories called Cowboys and East Indians. The book tells the stories of a variety of Indian characters living in Wyoming and explores what often reads as an unusual combination. McConaughey's father is an Irish-born petroleum geologist, and her mother, Nimi McConaughey, was the first Indian-born person to serve in the Wyoming legislature. Nina McConaughey grew up in Casper.
Growing up in Wyoming is like nothing you can experience anywhere else, but also very interesting because I look Indian and certainly Casper is not always the most diverse place. So, you know, growing up it was the best of a lot of things. And it was also, it gave me a lot of time to think about my identity and that I didn't look like everybody else.
The old adage goes, write what you know. But I'm curious, how did you come to decide to make East Indians in Wyoming the focus of your book? Was it hard to come up with material?
No, no, not at all. I mean, every single story in the collection has a tiny bit of autobiography, but I've experienced knowing some interesting people throughout the years, from motel owners to students I've had here at the university to people we've met at Sam's Club. I mean, really random connections we've made with Indians all over the state, which has been kind of amazing, and it's given me great material.
In the titular story, Cowboys and Indians, the narrator Faith is an Indian-born young woman living in Laramie who was adopted by Americans and raised in Wyoming. She offers a ride to a group of Indian college students walking to the store, and they feel each other out for cultural similarities and differences. Would you mind reading a section of that story for me?
Sure. They were not as impressed with the thrift shop's wares, and I could see why. The shelves were piled with odds and ends, decorative plates, figurines, old fishing reels, kitchen gadgets in immeasurable numbers. In the lined sections were sleeping bags with faded rainbows and army trucks on them, hand-tied quilts with patches frayed. Records, books, clothes, there were rows and rows of junk. It was all the debris of small-town America. But then they began to see the prices. Ronnie pulled out a thin silver phone and dialed. She spoke in quick tones to someone and then smiled at me. I told the boys they should come down here, and she pointed to a chair marked $5. There are many more Indian boys than girls at the university. I knew this already. I had seen them playing cricket in Prexy's pasture most nights before the snow came and turned the pasture into a slushy mess. In the late afternoon, one could hear the whack of bat against ball as the whole group of Indian men played cricket. When I walked by, none of them would make eye contact with me. I tried to smile, even stop and watch, but they all looked away. I looked Indian all right. I even had long black hair. But perhaps it was something in the way I walked, in my lace-up cowboy boots, in my ranch girl jeans that said, no, she's not.
Thank you. Now, having grown up in the U.S., I'm wondering how much you identify with your characters, especially the ones who come from India.
I obviously have grown up in Wyoming my whole life, but I certainly have seen how my mother sort of adjusted to life in Wyoming. The first year we lived in Wyoming, she didn't unpack our house. She didn't think we would stay. The weather alone, the wind alone is really hard. So I've seen that experience and I really relate with it. I did live in India for a year. And the feelings of dislocation I felt living in India were pretty intense. Just being from Wyoming, the space alone, I was not used to having people so around all the time. I wanted my space. So that was a real adjustment for me. So I know those feelings of being in another country and feeling really disconnected.
Your Indian characters really run the gamut. You've got immigrant children, you've got foreign students, business owners, a native Wyomingite. What did you want your readers to learn or consider about the realities of being Indian in Wyoming?
I think for me, so many beautiful story collections about the immigrant experience in America from people like Jhumpa Lahiri or Chitra Deva Karuni, they all are a very urban experience. They're in places like California. They're in places like Texas, where there are Indian grocery stores, where there are Indian restaurants, where there are other Indians. Being in Wyoming is very, very isolating because there isn't anyone else around that's Indian. And I think that rural immigrant experience is something I really wanted to capture. And I do think the characters then are going to be people like motel owners or students or people passing through in this very kind of odd way. I'm really obsessed with pioneer narratives. And, you know, Wyoming, especially Casper, is this amazing place where the Oregon Trail, the Pony Express, the Mormon Trail, the California Trail, they all pass through. And so I wanted to write a sort of new pioneer narrative about passing through in 2013.
Nina, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Nina McConaughey is a lecturer in the University of Wyoming's English Department. Her new book is a collection of short stories called Cowboys and East Indians. It's out on 5-chapter books at the end of the month.
We're going to hear now from a woman who was blind for the first 30-some years of her life. At that point, a doctor told her he could make her see. After 4 surgeries, she finally gained her vision. The woman's name is Pat Logan, and we'll hear a conversation she had with Dave Stratton, the chaplain for the Program for All-Inclusive Care for the Elderly in Cheyenne. The interview was recorded as part of StoryCorps, a project that records conversations between loved ones.
What's it like to live in a world with no sight?
You know, you grow up with it. I mean, it was just normal for me. First, I went to school for the blind in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And then I was in school with everybody else in elementary school. They had a special teacher who came and helped me. And I just went with everybody else. And again, still never realized that I was any different.
Did you try to think what it would be like to see?
No, I tried to imagine what things were. You know, you could touch a tree, but you couldn't. In my mind, I couldn't figure a tree. People would talk about a rainbow. Okay. The sky is blue. The sun is yellow. Okay.
What no context. Is that? There was no. Really no meaning for you.
It was just black.
Was there a desire to want to see when you were blind?
I wanted to see my son. I wanted to see people, my family. But I didn't realize I was really missing anything.
So take me back those few days up to the surgery and then walk me through that day.
It didn't mean anything yet. I could see some light, but I didn't know if I was going to see anything. So the day that the doctor gave me glasses and I could finally see, and he said, you want to look out the window and see the leaves on the tree? Well, I didn't know what a tree was, let alone the leaves on it.
Can you describe for me the emotion, the thought that
it still makes me tear up. I still get very lump in my throat when I think about it. But then we come out of the doctor's office, and he brings me out, and he stands there. And he doesn't, there's these things moving around. Okay, they must be people.
Oh, my. So this is the first time you've seen people?
Yeah, anything. Yes. And then I see my children, and along the way you see, what's that? That's a flower. What's this? Oh, it's a car. Traffic was scary.
did the sensation of being a person change for you?
Entirely.
Entirely.
I hadn't seen sunshine. I'd not seen, nothing. And I lived on Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. Hadn't seen the ocean, but I saw the ocean that day. And then my son gets out of school. And oh, my goodness, he would kill me if he heard me say I was beautiful, or he was beautiful, but he was. I learned the letters, what letters looked like from my children's blocks. They had then blocks with the raised letters on, the ABCs. So I knew how the letters felt, but it was still a little different to look at them on a piece of paper than it was on the feel them on the block. So,
do those moments when you first saw, are they being experienced now as you
still? I'm seeing all new things in Wyoming. I've just been here since January, and everything's new again. Sometimes I have to ask, what is that?
Because you don't know.
Because I don't know.
Could I see the way you see?
No.
Could I experience sight in the way that you experience
it? No, I don't think so.
I could appreciate
it. I think you could appreciate it, but maybe not quite as much as I do.
There's some painful part to this newness as well. You shared a little
bit
with me.
Just a couple things.
Would you be willing to share
sure.
a little bit about?
I became, from being a totally dependent person to being a totally independent person who said, after 38 years, I think I should get a job. I want to get out and do things. And my husband could not go along with that. He couldn't change to me not needing him totally, constantly, depending on him for, everything. I couldn't go out alone. I couldn't go shopping alone because I couldn't look at things on shelves. I couldn't pick out groceries. I didn't know how to write a check. I didn't know how to count money. And we ended up divorced. And that's when I moved to Aspen, Colorado. Saw snow for the first time. Saw a rainbow for the first time. And you've never seen a rainbow until you're almost there where you can reach out and touch it in the mountains at 10,000 feet. So again, it was change. I saw all new things.
Now I know, and I found out just today that your sight is also changing again.
Right. The one of my eyes I don't seem to use anymore. The other eye, the vision is low, but it doesn't matter. I have seen a rainbow. I've seen my grandchildren. I've seen my children. I know what things are now. Now if I lose my sight totally, I know what a tree is. I know what grass is. I know what blue is. I know what yellow is. I've been able to walk down the street by myself. I've been able to have a job. I've learned so many things that, I mean, what more can I ask for?
That was Pat Logan talking with Dave Stratton about growing up blind and then gaining her vision in her 30s. The piece was produced by Willow Belden with interviews recorded at StoryCorps. StoryCorps is a national nonprofit whose mission is to provide Americans of all backgrounds and beliefs with the opportunity to record, share, and preserve the stories of our lives.
Thanks for listening to this edition of Open Spaces. If you'd like to hear it again, listen to individual segments, or listen to previous episodes, you can go to our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org, and click on Open Spaces.
You can submit ideas for future programs on that website and comment on our stories. Anna Rader is our web editor.
We also invite you to become a fan of our Wyoming Public Radio News Facebook page, and you can find all of our reporters on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.